que président du château, je voulais vous dire combien nous sommes heureux, enfin, moi-même en dernier, mais surtout l'équipe du château, d'accueillir cette cinquième édition du Festival d'Histoire de l'Art. On a la chance d'avoir Yann Dibetz qui porte cette conférence inaugurale, mais le bonheur est de vous accueillir dans ce festival pour ces 3 jours. Pour le château de Fontainebleau, pour son équipe, c'est évidemment un moment tout à fait précieux, parce que de voir réunis tous ces amoureux de l'histoire de l'art, quel que soit votre degré de passion pour elle, dans cette maison qui a été un foyer de création artistique à travers les siècles, c'est quand même un très beau moment pour nous tous. Je vous rappelle que, j'espère qu'on ne se trompe pas avec Vincent Droguet, en disant que ce château est le seul qui a donné naissance à une école, l'école de Fontainebleau, bien connue, François Ier, autour de lui, tous les artistes italiens que vous connaissez, puis même après la première école de Fontainebleau, il y en a eu une seconde. Voilà, donc c'est un lieu tout à fait particulier pour l'histoire de l'art. Je ne vais pas insister plus là-dessus parce que vous en savez autant que moi sur la question. Donc bienvenue dans cette maison. Juste un mot pour vous dire que vous avez un programme formidable qui vous est proposé, vous le savez. Essayez de profiter aussi du lieu même. Il est là pour ça, il est ouvert, très largement ouvert. On accède à des endroits normalement fermés. Et les festivaliers ont la possibilité de se promener un peu partout dans le château. C'est un bonheur aussi, ça aussi c'est un bonheur pour l'équipe du château. Donc profitez du château, profitez des grands appartements, profitez peut-être du théâtre impérial qui a été inauguré l'année dernière, en tout cas la salle qui a été restaurée. Je ne sais pas si vous pourrez profiter du boudoir turc, je le dis quand même pour la première conférence, vous n'êtes pas si nombreux, mais on a inauguré le boudoir de Marie-Antoinette et de Joséphine il y a une quinzaine de jours. Il est très difficilement accessible, non pas parce qu'il y a 66 marches à grimper, mais parce qu'on ne peut y accéder que par groupe de 7 personnes. Donc, peu nombreux seront les élus. On a compté qu'il y aura peut-être 650 personnes qui pourront en bénéficier. On attend 30 000 visiteurs, donc voilà, c'est le ratio. Mais si vous pouvez, il est accessible à partir de la cour ovale. Et puis, je citerai pour terminer la grande exposition consacrée à Pie VII et à Napoléon, le rapport entre l'empereur et le pape, qui a été d'abord, vous le savez, invité très courtoisement dans cette maison, puis ensuite emprisonné, certes dans une geôle dorée, mais quand même emprisonné pendant 1 an et demi. Donc c'est une exposition, j'espère que vous l'apprécierez, avec des prêts très importants de beaucoup de musées français, et aussi évidemment du Vatican et de la famille de Pie VII. Donc profitez du château autant que possible, c'est le message que je voulais vous faire passer, et profitez bien sûr de cette 5e édition du festival. Merci de votre attention, je passe la parole à Antoinette Lormand-Romain, directrice générale de l'INHA. Merci.
Alors, à mon tour de vous dire combien je suis heureuse d'ouvrir cette 5e édition du Festival de l'Histoire de l'Art, dont le thème me semble particulièrement en phase avec tous les événements qui se sont déroulés cette année, dans la mesure où il ramène vers l'œuvre d'art et vers sa matérialité, nous incite à réfléchir peut-être sur le lien entre l'image qui est tellement accessible dans notre monde actuel, et l'œuvre d'art qui est définie par son lieu, par sa place, par la façon dont elle occupe l'espace, par sa matière, par le contexte dans lequel elle a été réalisée et dont on a parfois, hélas, tendance aujourd'hui à faire un objet de publicité et dans des directions qui sont évidemment totalement contraires à sa nature profonde. Alors je pense d'ailleurs que nous sommes ramenés vers cette matérialité de l'œuvre d'art en arrivant ici même dans cette salle des colonnes, puisque beaucoup d'entre nous ont pu se tordre les pieds sur les pavés de Fontainebleau, qui nous rappelle donc que l'œuvre d'art est quelque chose qui est véritablement physique et matériel. Mais ceci étant dit, je pense aussi que ça fait partie du plaisir que nous avons à nous retrouver dans ce cadre magnifique. Et je veux redire à Jean-François Hébert combien je pense que pour ce festival, le fait de se dérouler à l'intérieur du château de Fontainebleau, que nous avons l'impression d'habiter pendant ces quelques jours, qui nous est très très généreusement ouvert et rendu accessible, contribue, je pense, au succès de la manifestation. Alors, avant de laisser la parole à nos premiers intervenants, je veux les remercier, bien sûr, en mon nom et puis en notre nom à tous. Donc, nous avons l'honneur d'accueillir Yann Dibetz, qui, étant un artiste, donc, nous ramène vers le thème du festival, mais également vers le pays invité, qui est cette année, comme vous le savez, les Pays-Bas. Puis je veux remercier également Éric Varaghan, qui est maître de conférence à l'Université de Valenciennes, qui, si j'ai bien compris, a fait sa thèse sur Yann Tibbetts, donc qui est évidemment le mieux placé pour jouer le rôle de maître loyal. Alors, un grand merci à tous les deux et à vous tous. Que ces trois journées soient riches et soient bonnes.
Merci à vous, merci pour votre invitation. Merci à Yann de l'avoir accepté. Donc, le nom de Yann Tibbetts est associé à plusieurs notions, catégories et phénomènes qui ont marqué la création contemporaine de ces presque 50 dernières années, à ce que l'on nomme communément donc, la photographie plasticienne, dont il a été l'un des premiers à déconstruire les paramètres dès le dernier tiers des années 60, à l'histoire de l'art conceptuel, dont il a été un protagoniste, quand bien même problématique, pardon, majeur, mais aussi un passeur et promoteur, donc en mettant très tôt à la disposition de jeunes commissaires d'exposition, souvent inexpérimentés, donc à l'image du désormais légendaire Harald Zeman, donc ses réseaux et carnets d'adresses. Et on peut à ce titre rappeler, je referme aussitôt la parenthèse, hein, que Tibbetts a été à l'origine de l'exposition « Quand les attitudes deviennent formes », montée à la Kunsthalle de Berne en 1969. Son nom est enfin associé, et cela justifie sans doute sa présence aujourd'hui au sein de cette édition du Festival de l'Histoire de l'Art, donc associé à la persistance d'un particularisme culturel qui, à la fin des années 60 et au début des années 70, qui plus est dans un contexte conceptuel résolument globalisé, n'allait absolument pas de soi. Donc, l'œuvre de Tibbetts s'inscrit en effet dans une certaine filiation, qui en fait l'héritier d'une tradition picturale néerlandaise qui, de Saint-Rodam à Mondrian, a su se montrer réceptive aux enjeux d'une création sensible à des données formelles et thématiques auxquelles il a su donner, selon des moyens et médiums qui sont les siens, des survivances souvent inattendues et surprenantes pour un artiste affilié à l'art conceptuel. Nous tenterons aujourd'hui de revenir donc, sur les différents pans et chapitres de cette déjà longue trajectoire, en insistant bien entendu sur la genèse d'un propos auquel il est resté fidèle jusqu'ici. Car comme nous le verrons, l'œuvre de Tibbetts, quand bien même elle témoigne d'un renouvellement permanent, a su témoigner d'une forme d'obstination, le poussant donc régulièrement à revenir à des familles de travaux souvent délaissées quelques décennies auparavant, nous démontrant ainsi que les réponses données ici et là à des interrogations diverses ne sauraient être définitives. Donc, ce faisceau d'interrogations renvoie systématiquement donc, à des questions touchant à la circonscription de paramètres identitaires, donc des actes et images photographiques, au processus de transformation et de représentation qui nous font passer d'une réalité photographiée à une réalité photographique. Donc, ton nom est associé à l'histoire de la photographie plasticienne, mais à la différence donc, des étudiants qui, depuis les années 70, donc, ont pu se familiariser très tôt avec ce médium, tu n'as pas eu accès à celui-ci, du moins pas dans le cadre de ton apprentissage. Peux-tu revenir sur ces années pré-photographiques, sur tes années de formation et sur les étapes importantes qui t'ont peu à peu donc permis de t'extraire d'un cadre académique traditionnel.
Oh, this is the question you asked me. Okay, good. I see it in English. Well, academic teaching, no. Before I discovered the camera, I was trained as a classic painter and realized, actually, before I went to art school, I must say, I was at the gymnasium, as we call it, I was deeply impressed by Mondrian. And then I went to art school, and I came in the first day, and I saw all these students making a drawing. I came a week too late, and when I arrived at art school, I saw them all drawing a foot of plaster and a skull. And I couldn't believe, I thought this was past, you see. I thought this is classic, it's from the 17th century, and I couldn't believe that people still could do that, you know, that they still could really make a drawing. And that was a shock. Very strange, because I was not at all informed that this was a very normal academic training, so I got to do that. And well, that was very easily to master, I found out, but there is a big difference to make a drawing of anything you see or to make a fantastic drawing, which has a value in the arts. Okay, so when you become an artist and you have this whole past, the most important for an artist, for a young artist, is the unlearning. Everything you have learned, you have to get rid of, and you have to start all over. So then I realized that we lived in a time which was not at all anymore the time which I finally mastered at the art school, so I had to cope with a new world, and I had no idea how to get forms and find your own way in it. It's a very difficult process. It's like a it's like a caterpillar which has to turn in a butterfly. I mean, that happens after the art school. And that takes you 4 or 5 years, and they're the worst years you ever can imagine in your life. You are totally alone. You have no idea where the end is, where the beginning is. It's always dark, and there is no, how brilliant you are, there is no way out for your possibilities or your, you are in the dark, in the deep night. And finally, strangely enough, when I had left even painting, and I gave up because I realized this was a medium which didn't fit for some reason in the 20th century at that moment anymore, compared to minimal art, compared to people like Ryman, Judd, Carl Andre, Solowit, who I all knew well. And then I realized when I, for the first time, looked in a camera when I was 25, I couldn't believe what I saw. I thought, this is a forgotten world. There are millions of photographs, but there's not much thought about photography. And that's typical for an artist, not to master the medium, but to think about the medium. The, not the what of the medium, but the how of the medium. And that's, for photography, was a unexplored field.
Donc la photographie va donc intervenir progressivement dans ta trajectoire, je dirais même dans un premier temps de façon accidentelle, dans un premier temps donc sous forme plutôt de documentation, donc de travaux qui d'or par leur caractère éphémère ou de trompe-l'œil, donc nécessiter ou encourager une captation photographique. Puis peu à peu, donc comme tu viens de le dire, ce médium va donc véritablement rentrer donc dans ton œuvre et au cœur donc de ta démarche. Donc tout ça s'est passé finalement en quelques mois, entre fin 66 et début 67. Est-ce que tu peux revenir sur ces quelques mois déterminants qui t'ont poussé donc à assimiler donc ce médium photographique?
Yeah, the thing is, if you see it now in retrospect, everything looks very clear. But the problem is that when you make it, nothing is clear, because you don't know what the next day brings. And the only reason that I used the camera is actually that I needed the camera. That was to document these things which I was doing. Other way, they were lost. So they were made in places where nobody ever would go, or nobody would know what it was meant for. So by seeing it in the camera, I realized that the camera had much more to offer than anything I had been trying at that moment. So I started to find out what the ideas were which were hidden in the camera. I tried to master the camera not in a technical way, but in a visual way, to understand what a photograph could be, what time was, what light was, why there was a camera, why there was photography, why it was never explored, why it was always accepted to make a photograph from your uncle or your or your parents or your house where you were living, but never the thinking part of it. And that turned out to be for 200 years almost neglected. Some people had turned it over, and people like Mandray, of course, yes, Le Gray, there are people who have worked in the history, Muybridge, but that was so rare. And I didn't know any of those names. I had totally to begin from the beginning, from zero, and as an amateur, because I didn't technically, actually, I didn't want to know much about the camera, because what does it make for an artist if he studies a pencil or he studies the brush? That doesn't make a painting, and also not a drawing. So forget about it. It's about thinking, yeah. And experiencing, of course.
Donc la première véritable série de travaux photographiques, donc sont les corrections de perspective, hein, donc que tu vas entamer en 67. Hein, j'en explique rapidement le principe au public. Hein, donc il s'agit d'anamorphoses conçues à partir de formules mathématiques. Hein, donc pour les premières d'entre elles, tu traces des formes trapézoïdales, donc à l'aide de cordes sur le gazon qui photographié, donc à partir d'un point de vue précis, se transforme en carré. Donc tu vas accomplir par la suite la même opération dans ton atelier, hein, si ce n'est que tu n'emploieras plus de cordes, mais que tu traceras donc les formes à l'aide de crayons ou de rubans adhésifs. Hein. Donc là aussi, tu vas procéder en plusieurs étapes. Hein. Donc dans les premières versions, l'image photographique est marginalisée, hein, elle est reléguée dans un coin, avant de peu à peu donc, reprendre ses droits. Et certaines d'entre elles seront d'ailleurs imprimé donc directement sur toile, et ce passage à la toile est bien entendu très symbolique. Là par exemple un exemple donc d'une œuvre qui a été directement imprimée sur toile. Ceci vaut donc aussi pour les toutes dernières, en tout cas de 69. Donc la plupart de ces versions témoignent donc d'une recherche d'équilibre, hein, entre photographie et schéma et formules géométriques. Comment se sont déroulées ces différentes étapes ? Et imaginais-tu, en amorçant cette série, que les images et actes photographiques allaient à terme donc devenir le centre de tes préoccupations ?
Well, it's thinking about perspective. It's thinking about what the camera does, what it represents. But it's also mathematical basis where I at least had an anchor where I could keep myself hanging on, because they are actually, the perspective corrections are about insecurity. As mathematical and precise they look, they are very much about insecurity. The drawings later on, I thought they're almost like Mondrian's writing on art, which is, I think, has nothing to do with his paintings. He is a great painter, a fantastic 20th century artist, a modernist, but his writings is, in my opinion, it's ridiculous. And in a way, the perspective corrections and the drawings around it, it's all to prove that it's really true, what you see, but it's actually also a sign of insecurity. It's the same. It's not necessary to have these drawings, but they became necessary for me to explain to myself what I was doing. So it's like Mondrian defending himself in his writings about something which he is doing, which he doesn't understand. And that's typical for an artist. The artist doesn't understand himself. He is not the person who is secure he's going to do. Whether you speak about Rembrandt, whether you speak about Dürer or Jan van Eyck, it happens while you are doing it. Even if you are completely clear what you want and very precise and extremely skilled, the thing it is out of control. When you start making it, it's not there anymore. The theory comes right after it. And as nobody has a theory about it, what you do, you are the first one to make the theory. And the theory is totally unimportant. So it should be immediately thrown away. But it pops up all the time. Artists making theories. Bad artists can make very good theories. Good artists can't make theory. I'm absolutely sure. Yeah. I know a lot of bad artists who have written very beautiful on art.
Cette famille est bien entendu capitale, donc dans la mesure où s'y dessine donc l'une des constantes de ton œuvre, hein, savoir une tension, pour ne pas dire contradiction, entre le concept et l'image. Comment as-tu géré cette tension à la fin des années 60 ? En étais-tu pleinement conscient ? Et si oui, j'imagine qu'il n'était pas facile pour un artiste donc affilié à l'art conceptuel, donc qui est quand même la tendance la plus iconophobe du XXe siècle, donc d'assumer cette dimension iconique.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because on the first place, there again, an artist doesn't know what he does. He knows what he does, but it's based on intuition. And you have the conceptual art. Everybody speaks about conceptual art. I think there has never been a name in the art world which survived so many years. Conceptual art is already there for 30 years, and there are still people making conceptual art. It's totally ridiculous, because the conceptual art, before it was called conceptual art, were a few people who made works based on an idea and not an idea and then making a painting, but then working typical from the idea and strictly from the idea. But the moment the word conceptual art existed, and I think it's Solowit who used it for the first time, actually that was in 1970, it was over. That was the end of conceptual art. But I realized already at that time that it couldn't live very long, because we had a very split between the American artists who strictly stick to the idea, and the Europeans, some of them at least, and I'm for sure, thought an idea, yes, but what is an idea if you don't take the responsibility as an artist to give a form to your idea? And I was totally against the idea of Lawrence Wiener saying the artist can make the work, but he doesn't have to make the work, someone else can make the work. That to me, was taking the heart out of the art. I think that was not one bridge too far. To me, it sounded like stupid. So we had a problem there, and that was the end of conceptual art.
Est-ce qu'il y avait à l'époque des discussions entre artistes, notamment avec tes confrères justement conceptuels ou prétendument conceptuels, des discussions par exemple sur le statut de la photographie, parce que vous n'aviez absolument pas la même approche du médium?
No, as far as I know, the only serious talk I had about photography was in 68, few hours with Solowit, yeah.
That's all.
And that was fantastic. No, I mean, what can you talk about? Solowit had a very clear idea. He was against photography, but he said, but I'm not against your photography. But he was against photography. And then I said, listen, Sol, it's only because you don't understand what it is. And later he said to me, it was a 76 or 77 or so, he said, I remember always that you said you don't understand it. And you were right. I talked to you about photography from my point of view, and I understand now that you probably thought he's crazy. And so we misunderstood each other for 2 hours, but now I know what you talk about. Yeah, okay, so that was the only time I, besides to other people, you can talk about photography, but you, in fact, photography as art is an incredibly difficult medium to talk about. There is not much you can say.
Okay. Donc plus ou moins au même moment où tu mets un terme donc à tes corrections de perspective, tu entreprends une série de travaux qui visent davantage donc à déconstruire les paramètres temporels de la photo. Hein. Donc, tu t'attaches selon les cas donc à des données internes ou externes à l'appareil. Tu as cependant assez rapidement mis un terme au début des années 70 donc à ce type de déclinaison. Pourquoi avoir assez rapidement abandonné le facteur temporel ?
Because I thought they were no good.
Why?
They were no good. Unfortunately, you know, once you get a grip on something, again, I said, when you come from the art school, you start the unlearning, which is a difficult process. But an artist has also to give up ideas when he knows how to do them. And they become academic, although they look very avant-garde. No, they are also academic. And so there was a big fight in myself going on how to escape from it, but I had no idea. But then you have to give it up.
On peut peut-être mentionner deux œuvres qui s'inscrivent donc dans ce type d'interrogation. Le domaine d'un rouge-gorge et les Shutterspeed Pieces. Est-ce que tu peux rapidement nous parler de cette œuvre assez surprenante qui est le domaine d'un rouge-gorge?
Yeah, what can I say about it? It's a book about the territory of a bird, and it's a drawing in space. Let's say the early years of conceptual art. Anything crazy could be art, but nobody knew where the frontier was, where the end was, where it stopped. And so there you see, strangely enough, that by the early 70s, 71, 73, 73, 74, the imitation of the first conceptual art came, and then you see the incredible stupidity which came out. You know, so then you realize that it is a devastating and ruinous process where you are in, which is breaking down. You think you are building up, but you're also at the same time breaking down the arts. And it's the search for how far can you go. Yeah, that's what it is.
But maybe you could describe this work. What was the concept?
From the rouge gorge.
Yes.
The concept was a drawing made by a bird flying all the time the same poles. You know, which I had put. I changed the territory. You see, the red-breast robin is famous for having a very strong small territory, which he defends virulently. So it's the idea was to have poles setting just outside of his territory, which he accepted as ideal watchouts for other birds intruding his territory. But that meant that he was flying my drawing, which I made with the poles.
En fait, j'explique rapidement l'œuvre. Donc, Dibetz a observé le domaine d'un rouge-gorge, hein, qui correspond plus ou moins à ce périmètre. Et puis, il a donc placé des espèces de piquets donc à quelques mètres donc du territoire initial, et a fait en sorte en fait que le rouge-gorge donc modifie sa trajectoire. Mais I thought it was all was fake, because in this interview with Chérix, you say, yeah. So was it real or was it not real?
No, it's fake, of course.
Mais donc en fait c'est une supercherie, et mais qui a été dévoilée il y a très peu de temps, parce que c'est dans un entretien, je sais pas, en 2009, que Dibetz a finalement...
But the thing is, you speak on two ways. Well, no, I have a deposit at a notary that it's fake, in case I came under a car, that everybody should see that it's fake. But I started it in reality, and it took forever, but the first pole was working. But that took already 2 months, so that was too much.
Okay. Can you maybe say something about the shutter speed pieces?
Well, the shutter speed pieces is about light, it's about what photography can do, it's about the simplicity and the beauty. It's about a representation of how light is represented by a camera. And it is also the image of something which brings light, you know, so it's it's Luxoflex. Yeah.
Donc suite à ces travaux donc autour du temps hein, ou de la traduction du temps à travers la photographie, tu vas commencer à t'intéresser de très près donc à un motif qui va prendre une place très importante donc au sein de ta trajectoire. Donc il s'agit de la ligne d'horizon qui sera donc timidement introduite donc à la fin des années 60, puis qui va véritablement devenir donc un motif à part entière donc dans la première moitié des années 70. Cette ligne aussi me semble importante dans la mesure où elle te permet ou elle t'a permis donc d'inscrire ton propos dans une certaine histoire de l'art néerlandais. Étais-tu conscient donc au moment d'entreprendre ces travaux autour de la ligne que tu t'inscrivais donc dans cette histoire à laquelle tu avais sans doute tenté en tout cas dans un premier temps d'échapper?
That's the, about horizon.
Yes. About horizon, and if you knew, well, if you were conscious about the fact that you were inscribing your work again in the history of Dutch art.
In a way, yes, of course. But who doesn't like Ruisdael? I mean, that's beautiful. And the Koning 17th century landscape painter, there you see the horizon all the time. But the horizon is also a fascinating thing for a photograph because the photograph suggests a mathematical form almost, much more than a painting. And so I used the horizon more or less constantly as a mathematical form. And then the possibilities are totally unlimited if you start to think from the camera. You can twist it, you can turn it, you can reconnect it, you can disconnect it, you can put it in any way where you want. Yeah.
Et tu as renoué avec ce motif dans les années 2000, hein, donc you started again.
Yes, I realized that I had used it and I thought it was finished, especially with the comets which I did. But then I found out much later that I had forgotten the whole part, so I restarted again.
Another important series is the color studies.
No.
Donc une autre famille d'œuvres qui sera d'ailleurs assez problématique et génératrice de conflits, et donc la famille des color studies que tu as également reprise récemment. Hein. Donc tu peux peut-être revenir sur cette série qui a aussi été un fiasco total, hein, donc aussi bien sur le plan critique qu'économique. On peut rappeler à titre anecdotique, hein, que Suzanne Paget, donc au moment d'organiser donc ta rétrospective, donc au début des années 80, avait dans un premier temps donc refusé donc de montrer ses travaux. Peux-tu revenir sur ces années et sur cette famille en particulier?
Well, they were misunderstood. But by everybody. I mean, Leo Castelli said to me, "Jan, I like them, but you can't sell them." And I had invested an enormous amount of money to get all this new material that had come from America. And it was for the first time that you could print bigger than just this size, 50 by 50, so you could have 1 meter 10 by 1 meter 10. And it cost all a fortune, and then people have absolutely no connection to it. So because of financial reasons, after I had spent an enormous amount of money, I got bankrupt more or less, and I had to give it up. But that was simply because I had reached the border of what was possible and probably not possible. And that was technically what I wanted was technically almost impossible. So I came really at the point that the technical people told me, you know, forget about it. It doesn't exist. What you want doesn't exist. But that was 20 years later. We had the revolution that we got into the digital photography. And there was everything which I tried 25 years before was very easily possible. So for that reason, I came back to it. But I had to stop at that time because I had reached the limits which were. So I had to retreat.
Okay, after the correspondence.
Yeah.
Donc après, en tout cas à la fin des années 70 et dans les années 80, tu vas surtout te consacrer à des travaux qui s'articulent donc autour de motifs architecturaux, donc des travaux qui témoignent d'un sens de la construction, même de la composition plus affirmée, et qui sont finalement très loin donc, de la sobriété minimaliste en noir et blanc donc, de la fin des années 60. Et pourtant, il s'agit toujours pour toi encore de trouver une forme d'équilibre donc, entre les enjeux touchant à la chose photographiée et photographique. Et il s'agit enfin d'une nouvelle étape dans ton œuvre, étant donné que tu vas y réintroduire en fait, une matière picturale. Tu peux parler de ce qui s'est passé donc, là aussi dans les années 80.
It's about the panoramic. Yeah, well, they speak for themselves.
There's nothing to say.
Yeah. They're so easily accessible. Well, they're for a big deal there again. I tried something which probably doesn't exist, so it was a failure. But a failure in art doesn't mean that it's not good. It can be very good, but it's still for the artist a failure, you know. So if you have a clear idea, my idea was that a photograph, especially if you go back to the one which was there before, the gray one. The idea was you can take the background away from something which is represented, but a photograph never has a background. It has the background by nature, you know, as a thing. But in painting, you create the background. And for an artist, if he looks to a painting, the background is much more intriguing because the painting is not the portrait. If you see a painting by Hans Holbein or whoever these portraitists are, you see that they make the drawing very, very fine with a silver line. And they are so well equipped in their profession. They are so very good. They make this portrait very easily. But around the portrait, they paint and paint and paint till this face starts to glow up. But the miracle is in the background. And if you don't look to the if you don't look like everybody looks at the painting like this, but you look from the side like this, then you see that the painting of the face is just flat and there's almost nothing there. But around it, it's very thick because the background is much more difficult to master than the classical thing which you can learn to make a beautiful portrait. That's one thing. But to give it a load, a power, which intrigues you, then you see that the work is in the background. And I thought maybe realizing this all my life, you know, and being a big fan of these people who really wrestle with this idea of that background, the fascination about it, I thought that something like that would be possible in photography. But it turned out that it didn't exist. Yeah.
And that's also the case of all the works you made around windows at the end of the 80s.
I was so happy that I could go back to my horizons, and then when I realized that the invention of digital photography had passed already, that was much more fascinating.
Maybe we could end this discussion on and talk about this this digital photography, because yeah. you finally came to it at a few years.
Yeah.
Why so late? Sorry,
Actually, I was so busy with my failures that I didn't realize that the world had moved on, and that things which I had tried 25 years before was within hand reach. So I thought, you know, I'd go back to it and start again. But talking about photography, one thing I would make very clear, would like to make very clear, the history of photography is 200 years old. And I think we haven't realized enough in those past 200 years, and certainly the first 100 years, how dangerous the invention and how devastating and ruinous this invention has been. Because it's a poisonous snake. It's not, we have 40,000 years of civilization, and we have made sculptures, we have made paintings, we have grown to it, we have started to call it art. I am deeply impressed by all this, what we know. I love this old classic painting. But then photography came. And we have never reflected on it really, because we haven't realized that after 40,000 years of civilization in a one-way thinking, the development of painting, the development of sculpture, we have a new medium. And this new medium turns out to be ruinous. It's taking over everywhere. And whether we want it or not, we have no grip on it. We think, how nice, we finally not have anger, you don't have to pay a fortune. No, we make a photograph and your uncle is there, your mother is there, your father is there, your house is there. But at the same time, there are billions of photographs taken, and we are moving away from text people, reading people, to image people. And being image people, they are other people. And we don't realize enough that from the photograph has come the film, has come the TV, has come your telephone in your pocket, your computer. The digital way photography is moving away also from photography and representation. It's absolutely not the case anymore whether a photographer makes a very nice photograph, who has the decisive moment. Bullshit. We are going to something which we don't know. And in that way, I have a very pessimistic view on the future of the arts. Yeah. I don't know. We are entering a very stormy, difficult period where we have a very confusing view on our own producing. Yeah. Yeah.
Bon, but that. You can finish on this very negative note if you want.
It's not negative. It's on the artist to find out how to handle it. But I know, I feel, and I've taught all my life with pleasure. But and I have a lot of much more famous artists than I might myself, which I teach. But I see where they are. They're all stuck in a big problem. It's a problem you can't go back. You know, there is no way back. For art, there is never a way back. There is always a way forwards. But the way forwards is so complicated and so unclear. Look to it. Go to New York. Go to one gallery to the other. There is no line. There is no clearness. At least minimal art was a very clear thing. Conceptual art was probably the last time that there was a clear idea about what you wanted. Have an idea, but that is finished. I wouldn't know what it could be. Hmm? Okay.
Bon, un grand merci à Yann.